see how that goes.
All right, you know what? Okay, you know what? How about this? We'll tie that into Hanukkah. And we'll tie that into the parsha also, to this past week's parsha, for extra points. You ready? Okay. So let's start talking about Hanukkah, and we'll tie that in. We know that when it comes to Hanukkah, we have an unusual focus on Hiddur. And the Gemara tells us that there is a concept not only of Hiddur, of doing a mitzvah in a beautiful way, but in doing a mitzvah in a couple of stages. So the Talmud tells us that it's a very basic level, and it's funny because if you talk about a menorah, so menorah is one of the most recognizable symbols of Judaism. If you ask anybody in the street, certainly in New York City, what's a menorah? So they'll tell you, in Chicago also, they'll tell you, what's a menorah? Menorah, everybody knows that Jews need to light menorahs on Hanukkah, one candle the first night, two candles second night, three candles third night, etc. Everyone knows that, except for the Talmud. Right, because according to the Talmud, it's not true. The Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, on Daf Chaf Aleph, that mitzvah Chanukah is what? Ner Ishu Beso. One candle per household per night, every night. First night, third night, eighth night of Chanukah, one night, no matter what, one candle. Doesn't matter how many people, doesn't matter how many nights. If you want to go above and beyond, you want to be from the Mahadran, then still no menorahs. Then it's one candle per person in the household. Ner l'kol echad v'echad. If you want to be super duper extra religious, you want to be from the Mahadran, min a Mahadran, from within the Mahadran, you're the Mahadran. Then we can start talking about menorahs, and it's a machlokas Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, that according to Beis Shammai, we count from eight down to one, and our practices, like Beis Hillel, we go from one up to eight. So, question is, first of all, what's behind those two opinions? No one follows Beis Shammai. Beis Shammai says we should be counting down the days, or perhaps as an alternative explanation the Gemara provides, that it's to parallel Sukkos. At Sukkos, the Karbanos descend, so too the lights on Hanukkah should descend. What in the world does Sukkos have to do with Hanukkah? It's a good question. Some explain that some of the earlier sources suggest that year, because they couldn't get into the Beis HaMikdash, they couldn't observe Sukkos in the Beis HaMikdash. And so therefore, when they finally got in Kislev, so Hanukkah was instituted as an eight-day festival to replace Sukkos. So that's an interesting topic to explore in other contexts, that there is a parallelism that's intentional between Sukkos and Hanukkah. There's a lot to discuss about that, just some food for thought for now. But in any event, that's Beis Shammai's opinion. And Beis Hillel's opinion is that when we follow, we go from one to eight. Why do we go from one to eight? So either because we want to count the days as they pass, or because we have a concept of Milan Vikodesh Ve'en Maridin. Now here again, food for thought, it's a mysterious application, because that's not what it means anywhere else. Anywhere else we mean, if you have something that was used for a holy purpose, so then we'll only use it for equal or greater holy purposes. We'll only go up in holiness with an object, with an individual. The idea that something that's related to a mitzvah, we should only count higher numbers, was not really the normal usage of Milan Bekodesh. Okay, again, that's something to think about for a different time. But in any event, we follow Beis Hillel, so we go from one to eight. Now, it's very striking that nobody does the basic mitzvah anymore. I don't know if you've ever been to anyone's house or seen anyone light one candle on the fourth night of Hanukkah. And it's not even recorded in the Shulchan Aruch, which is itself interesting. Shulchan Aruch just skips this whole discussion, tells you this is how you do it. But there is a machlokas about a detail of the menorah plan. Tosus over there in Shabbos raises the question. Tosus says, how exactly do you do the math here? So let's say you have a desire to follow the basic plan. So then you do one candle per household. Let's say you have three people in your household and it's the fourth night of Hanukkah. So the basic plan is you do one candle every night. Let's say you want to do the silver plan per person. So how many candles are you going to do every night? Three. Any night of Hanukkah is always going to be three. You go for the premium plan. What do you do? How many candles do you light?
3X.
Sorry?
3X.
3X is what it sounds like. You'd think they keep building on each other. But, says the Ri in Tosfos, it's not going to work because you light 12 candles then. 3 times 4, 4th night of Hanukkah, 3 people, so 3X. So you're going to put 12 candles in your window. What's that going to mean to anybody? So they'll walk past, they'll see 12 candles, they'll think maybe there's 5 people, 4 people in the house and it's the 3rd night, 3 people and it's the 4th night, 6 people and it's the 2nd night, 1 person, you're not even Jewish. What does 12 mean to anybody? 12 is going to be a very mysterious number. So, therefore, says Tosfos, because of this concern for Hecker, that it should be clear, there should be some message that we can see. So, therefore, the assumption's got to be that you don't build plans on top of each other. If you're going to go for the premium plan, skip the basic, skip the silver plan. So, if you're going per night, do not combine that with the per person count. Yes, sir.
People still don't realize either could get the fourth night either be four
correct
people and
yep.
The first night or one person the fourth night.
That's a good point. Would you like a napkin?
No.
That's all I have to offer. That's a good point. It's a very valid question. I'll have to set that aside for a second. It's clearly something that's a little bit mysterious here. But in any event, this concern for Hecker that it should be recognized, so that's Tosfos' concern, and that's what Tosfos assumes, that you only do per night, you don't do per person. You don't combine the systems, which could mean that, it's a little bit funny, that if you're moving up from the silver plan to the premium plan, you could end up doing less. Because it could be that, say you have 3 people in the household, and it's the 4th night of Hanukkah, so then on the silver plan, you'd be lighting 4 candles, and then you move up to the premium plan, and you do 3 candles, which is a little surprising. The other view is the view of the Rambam, that emerges from the Rambam, that he doesn't seem to be worried about this. Yeah, you combine the numbers, you multiply 12 candles, it's their problem to try to figure out what exactly 12 candles means. It doesn't seem to bother him. You combine the silver plan with the premium plan. 3 times 4 in this example. How do we paskin on this? So here there is an interesting inversion that normally the Sfardim, Shulchan Aruch, follows the Sfardi Rishonim. And the Ramah modifies that for Ashkenazi practice following the Ashkenazi Rishonim. Here there is a crisscross. The Taz on the side of the page says this is unique. Zelo Matzinu Bashar Makomos, that there should be a crisscross. But that's what seems to happen here, that the Shulchan Aruch follows the view of Tosfos, of the Ashkenazi Rishonim, that you should not combine the plans. And the Rambam apparently is apparently followed by the Ramah, that the Ramah seems to take this view that you do combine the plans. So that's unusual. And there's a lot of discussion, again, we can only get to some of it today. Maybe some of these points we can follow up in future discussions. We still have a couple weeks till Hanukkah. But there's a lot of discussion. Is the Ramah really following the Rambam, or is the Rambam actually different? Because there is a significant nuance that the Rambam actually says you combine the systems. So you light 12 candles, in our example, 3 times 4. But in the Ramah's version, it's not exactly the same. The Ramah says that the third level, everyone in the household lights per night. So all of the 3 people will light 4 candles. So yes, it adds up to 12 candles, but there is a significant difference in how it's presented. The Rambam seems to say that the head of the household is going to light 12 candles. Really not so worried about the confusing message that sounds. While the Ramah is not taking that wholesale. And there are some who suggest that the Ramah is not really paskening like the Rambam, he's actually paskening like both. Because he's taking the idea that we should combine the systems, but he's satisfying Tosfos' concern about Hecker, because you'll have, let's say, 3 menorahs of 4 candles each. So somebody will walk past your house and they'll see 3 separate presentations of 4 candles. It won't be so mysterious. So there's a lot of discussion. Does the Ramah really follow the Rambam, or is it some kind of combination? But essentially, this is the debate between Tosfos and the Rambam. So far, so good? It makes sense, yes?
Why is it so important for people to be able to see what it is?
Okay, great question. You can get two napkins. So, these are the candies that we have here. So, the guys just had a beautiful Malav Malka last night, so they're all treated out. But, so, this was a question in general. What is behind that machlokas? Why does Tosfos care about Hecker so much? And the Rambam doesn't seem to care. Why is it so important? So many of the later Svarim talk about this question. And there's a certain approach that they suggest. And B'mechila, I'd like to suggest the exact opposite, in a sense. But just to, you have to see the approach first to see how it can be inverted. So, for example, Yaakov Betzalel Zsolti with the Rebbe of Yerushalayim until the 1980s when he passed away, and is the author of a sefer called Mishnas Yaveh. So he is among many who explain in the following fashion. He says, we know there is a concept of Hidur Mitzvah that applies B'chol Torah Kula. Every morning we say, Az Yashir, so we say, Zek Keli V'Anvehu. So how do you translate that? This is my God. What does the Anvehu mean? So Herman Wuk, all of the Shalom, just passed away last year, so he wrote the book called This Is My God. That was the easy part to translate. What does Anvehu mean? He didn't get to the sequel. What is Anvehu? So the Gemara has a machlokus in Shabbos and Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel. Yeah, Levi, what is Anvehu?
I will beautify it.
I will beautify it, or him.
Yeah,
him. So one opinion in the Gemara says that it's actually about B'halachta B'drachah, like we spoke about a little bit last week. The word should be read as Ani Vahu, Anvehu, Ani Vahu, me and him together, I will be with him. But the other explanation in the Gemara over there is that it comes from the word Nava, beautiful, and it means I will beautify him, it, maybe suggests, through, sorry?
Yeah, I've seen like it before.
Okay, so it meaning the mitzvot.
Yeah.
His noah, the fun of.
Probably like an art school translation where they, like, you know, read that
shot
into the...
Yeah, either way, it's going to be it or them or him, but I will beautify through mitzvos. I will do mitzvos in a nice fashion. Tzitzis na, sefer Torah na, etc., says the Gemara. That's what we talk about when we mean hidr mitzvah, and that's what zeh keli v'anvehu means. So many suggest you could ask the following question. When the Gemara talks about this whole plan of Mahadran by Hanukkah, is that just one more example of the Mahadran of Hidr Mitzvah that you have by everything? The same idea you would have by Tefillin or by a Sefer Torah or by Tzitzis, we're applying to Hanukkah? Or should we say that no, there is a unique concept here? I'm not just saying Hidr Mitzvah, saying Mahadran at another level, Mahadran min a Mahadran. This is a different conversation. This is not about Zekeli Vandeyu. This has nothing to do with having nice tzitzis or a nice Sefer Torah. This is a unique concept in Hanukkah. Different kind of hiddur. So what difference does it make whether you call it one or the other? So what Rav Zsolti wants to suggest is that when it comes to hiddur mitzvah in general, there's an assumption that a hiddur mitzvah has got to be something visible. It doesn't apply to anything no one's going to see. So, for example, some of the Rishonim maintain that if you have a Sefer Torah, the Ksav has to be beautiful, has to be Mahudr. And in fact, we insist that a Sefer Torah have Sirtut, there should be underlines in the Sefer Torah scratched into the parchment. Can't see them from afar, but they're scratched into the parchment so that the lines will be nice and straight. The Sefer Torah has to be beautiful. What about the Parshiyos of Tefillin? They also have to be nice and beautiful. So some of the Rishonim, the Tosfos and Menachos about this, some of the Rishonim say no. Why? Because who sees the Parshiyos of Tefillin? Only the Sofer, and no one ever looks at them again. So that, maybe there's no point in Hidr Mahdi Kosher. But Hidr, maybe we don't have a concept of Hidr by something that's not visible. So Zsolti suggests that Tosfos is concerned about Hidr because Tosfos believes this is an example of the classic standard Hidr Mitzvah. It only makes sense if it's visible. If it's not visible, there's no point. While the Rambam, why does he not care? Because the Rambam sees this as a whole different concept. This is not Zekeli Vanvehu as applied to Tefillin or Tzitzis. This is something else that is built into how the mitzvah is performed, and we don't really care about it being perceptible. doesn't necessarily have to be something that the onlooker can understand. So that's how a number of Achronim explain it. So I'm wondering if we can invert it. Use the same explanation in kind of an opposite way. And say that really, the truth is, you have to say that according to everybody, there is a unique hiddur of Hanukkah. By its very nature, Hanukkah has a separate relationship to hiddur than everything else. And just to give one example to prove that, normally the Gemara says in Bava Kamma that when it comes to hiddur mitzvah, there's a limitation to how much you're expected to invest in a hiddur mitzvah. It's only so far you have to go. So let's say you see a nice esrog, and you see an even nicer esrog that costs 10 times as much as the first esrog. So you have an obligation to buy the esrog that costs 10 times as much. So the Gemara says that the reasonable hiddur is ad shlish. It means to add a third. That's a machlokus, how you count the third. Is it 50% or 33%? Machlokus, if it's really talking about spending. But whatever it is, on some level, it's a proportionate hiddur of adding a third. So if you see a nice esrog that costs $15 and a nicer esrog that costs $20, okay, so that makes sense to get the $20 esrog. But the second esrog costs $150, costs 10 times as much, doesn't really make sense. So here, how's the math going to work when it comes to Hanukkah candles? So according to the basic level, you only have to light one candle per night. So it's 8 candles total. So if you have the most minimal hiddur, just the second level, just the mahadra, and let's say there are 2 people in the household, already you have doubled your expenses. Now you need twice as many candles. And forget about it if you have more than 2 people in the household, and certainly if you're going to start adding up an extra candle per night, clearly the mahadran is demanding of you many, many times as much expenses as you would have for the basic level. So there's something clearly out of whack with the normal rules of hiddur. And everyone's going to have to acknowledge that. So clearly there's already something different about the hiddur of Hanukkah. It doesn't follow the rules. So I think Tosfos and the Rambam have to both agree to that. They have to both acknowledge that Hanukkah is not, this mahadran is not a normal mahadran. But then there's still a question. The question is, okay, it's not a normal mahadran, but how unusual is it? Does it essentially follow the pattern of a normal hiddur mitzvah? It just has a greater level of commitment. So normally, with a regular hiddur mitzvah, there's a limit to how far you have to go. But Hanukkah, we don't have that limit. And even though it's going to cost many times more, we would say, go for it. Is that the idea? That it's essentially the same kind of hiddur, it's just applied in a more intense fashion to Hanukkah? Or is it a radically different hiddur that has nothing to do at all with the hiddur that you find by everything else? And if that's the case, so then I think it's inverted, that it's actually the Rambam who has a more standard notion of hiddur here, just with greater obligation, and Tosis that has a completely different vision of what hiddur could be. So how does that play out? Why is that the case? Because what does hiddur normally mean? So normally it means something flashier, something more aesthetically pleasing, something that's going to attract more attention. So according to the Rambam, what is the plan for hiddur by Neres Hanukkah? It's just bigger. There's a scheme for how it gets bigger. There's a plan. But at the end of the day, it's just a bigger presentation. And basic level would have been one candle, and the mahadran would have been 3 candles, and the mahadran is going to be 4 candles. So it just means that the onlooker is going to see something bigger and bigger and bigger. So essentially, that's not radically different than an esrog, a bigger esrog that's a little bit more aesthetically grabbing. So that's the same kind of concept here. It's just that there is this difference, that there is a greater commitment to it than you would have otherwise. Tosfos is introducing a completely radical point. As Rami was asking, why do we care that you should be able to read? Why should we care that you should be able to count the numbers? Now, what's important, this is why it's different than what Rav Shulti was saying, is that It's not like the parshiyos of tefillin, where no one sees them, so hiddur doesn't necessarily apply. According to everybody, the hiddur is going to be visible. No one's saying that you should light in a closet. The question is just, is it going to make a message that people should be able to interpret? The Rambam and Tosfos both agree that the hiddur should be something you can see. The question is just, is there an extra component that we should read a message in it? So according to Tosfos, it's as if we said that the Rambam says in Sukkos you should have a bigger esrog, and Tosfos says you should have an esrog that dances around and sings and plays music and says happy Sukkos when you take it out of the box. So that's a whole different concept. Doesn't apply to hiddur anywhere else. So what is that machlokas about in general? So are those who suggest that this ties into the question of what exactly are we celebrating on Hanukkah? Which sounds like an ironic question, because everybody knows we're putting such effort into advertising something. We have this crucial directive of Persume Nisa. So it would be nice to know what the Nei says we're being Mefarsim, to have a whole focus on awareness. Everyone come and join us for a dinner for awareness, and we don't know what we're trying to be aware of. So that sounds like something that should probably get cleared up. So the truth is, not so obvious what the Nes of Chanukah is. If you ask a kid in third grade, so he'll tell you that the Nes of Chanukah is the Pach HaShemen, that the oil lasted so much longer than it was supposed to last. But our key expression of Hodah on Chanukah, when we actually spell out what we are happy about, is Al HaNisim. And we incorporate an extra paragraph into Shemona Esrei and into benching, and that's where we take the time to expand on the hodah that's a part of davening and benching, and we get into detail, thank you specifically for the miracle of Hanukkah. What do we say in Al HaNisim? What do we say about the Pach HaShemen? Absolutely nothing. No words about the Pach HaShemen. It's all about the military victory. So it seems like the miracle is the Nitzachon HaMelchama, is the victory in the war. So which is it? Is it the oil, or is it the military victory? So there are those who suggest that this is the Machlokas, the Rambam and Tosfos, that the Rambam holds that it's the military victory, so the numbers really don't matter. It's only about that. And others suggest, and then maybe it's what Tosfos is getting at, that we are interested in advertising the Pach HaShemen, and therefore it's crucial that there be a consistent message that people can interpret of going from 1 to 8 and increasing recognition of what that miracle means. So far, so good. So it's also very instructive to consider the view of the Maral of Prague and others of a similar approach, who suggest that there is a crucial relationship between these two. That when it comes to the main theme of Hanukkah, really it is the military victory. That's what makes a difference to us today. That's why we're here today. That's what we have to take note of so many centuries later. The Pach HaShemen was nice, but doesn't affect us at all. There's no difference to who we are today because of the Pach HaShemen. There's no reason why we should have a festival devoted to that. So what is the importance of the Pach HaShemen? The concern is that we could have this great victory, and we could think that what? Kochi v'otzem yadi asu li yasachal. This was done because we had great generals, we had great soldiers, we knew how to outsmart them. That was why we won. God has nothing to do with it. So at the end of this whole story, what happened? God essentially pulls off a magic show. It's not necessarily so significant, but it emphasizes what was happening all along. It shows God's presence in this world, and that's why it's significant. And that is what declares, that's essentially God's signature on everything that came before. Pach HaShemen is less significant to us, but it highlights the fact that this was miraculous, and therefore everything that happened before was also miraculous. Now, if we think about that in the context of the hiddur of Hanukkah, and essentially what we're positing here is that everyone agrees that Hanukkah has a unique relationship with hiddur, that either the hiddur is the same as everything else but more obligatory, or it's fundamentally different. One way or another, Hanukkah is connected to the concept of hiddur in a way that's different from other things. So why is that? So there are some who suggest there are various forms of this, three or four different versions of this idea, that maybe the whole Nes was about hiddur, if we focus on the Pach HaShemen for a second. Why is that? So just to give one of the versions, perhaps the most often quoted version, is the question of Pnei Yehoshua and others discuss, and say, why was the miracle of the Pach HaShemen even a thing in the first place? That they didn't have any Tahar oil. The oil was all Tameh. Okay, but we have a rule that Tuma Hutra B'tzibur, that something which is Tameh, can be used by the tzibur, by the community as a whole, if that's all they have. So they could have used the Tameh oil anyway. So why'd they need this whole miracle in order to get them something that wasn't really necessary? So there are a lot of razzle-dazzle answers to that question. But some give an answer that seems very not razzle-dazzle. They say that, you're right, they could have used the Tameh oil anyway. But it's nicer to use the tar oil. In other words, the whole miracle was for the purpose of hiddur. And there are different versions of that. So, for example, some suggest they could have gotten tar oil from somewhere closer, but this was the best oil, so that's why they needed this long trip. Others, the Beis Lake discusses that the truth is there's no minimum size of wicks. They could have cut wicks that were very, very thin, and the same oil would have lasted eight times as long if they hadn't used wicks that were so thick. But they wanted to have a nice flame. They wanted to have it be strong. So that was why they did it that way. One way or another, comes to the same point that hiddur was fundamental to why this happened. So why is that true? Why is hiddur so crucial here and not everywhere else? So the truth is, if we think about the whole crisis at the core of the Hanukkah story, so we're at war with the Hellenists and with those who would try to impose Greek culture on us. So it feels a little awkward for us to talk about that in the middle of a university. And so we have embraced the greater culture. We obligate you guys to take finals and to write papers and to take classes in all aspects of general world culture. So where does the Hanukkah story fit in? So we could formulate it as follows, that yes, we very much believe that there is a lot to gain from so much of the general culture the world has brought to us. But the question is, how do you perceive that? Do you perceive it as something that's just there and there is no God who is watching over things? The world is just a machine and there are things that are beautiful and there are things that are interesting and fascinating, but there is no overarching wisdom and design and plan for that? Or do you see all of that as contributing to a picture and to a plan that comes from a divine author? So why is hiddur so significant? If you're dealing with a machine, so hiddur doesn't really play a role. If you're trying to turn on your car, so you put the key in the engine or however you do it nowadays and you push the button and you turn on the car, and it either goes on or it doesn't. There's no inyan of turning it on behider. There's no mitzvah and a mufchar of how you'll turn it on better. It's either going to go on or it's not going to go on, more or less. So phones can be a little more complicated, but that's the basic idea with machines. Why would you try to do something in a better way? There's a way that works and a way that's better. Why would you try to do something in a better way than what works? Because you believe there's somebody watching who cares. If there's nobody watching who cares, then whatever works, works. And it doesn't matter. But if you believe that there is a God above for whom all of this comes together and all of this makes sense and all of this is part of a picture, so then hiddur becomes something that we want to pay attention to. So Hanukkah, perhaps, is about our recognition that all of the beauty in this world and all of the wisdom in this world and all of the culture in this world is meaningful if we can see it within a framework of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's mission for us. And that's reflected by our recognition that he's paying attention to what we do, and that he cares about how we do it, and that the world is not just a machine where you light a candle and you can see and that's it. And perhaps that's why, and there's much more to talk about all the different angles of this, but perhaps that's why also we find that Hiddur plays such a role in terms of Hanukkah, and maybe in some of the future weeks we'll have some time to explore how some of those ideas impact various other components of both Neres Chanukah and Chanukah itself and its underlying themes. And just to connect it a little bit to the Parsha, so those of you who were present at the Mlava Malka last night, so we heard very beautiful words from the president about the Parsha and about the concept of Lasuach Basada and the idea that Yitzchak instituted Tfilas Mincha, and that's how Chazal understands the idea of the Sicha, the idea, we normally translate that as a conversation, what exactly that word means. So Chazal tell us that it means he was davening. He was praying, and therefore it indicates that there is a tefillah that he was invoking, and that's where we get mincha from. So the truth is, it's fascinating because, as the president pointed out last night, it's not easy to translate the word lasuach. So we talk about sicha nowadays as a conversation, but there are a lot of different possible connotations, and if you look at the mefarshim on Chumash, you could find many different angles on how exactly we should understand the idea of sicha. And it's interesting because when it comes to mincha, which is a component of this idea, whatever these words mean, so there is a machlokas harishonim, a machlokas the Rambam and the Tur. When is the ideal time to daven mincha? So we know, especially now, it's the winter months, so everything is in a tighter time frame as far as mincha. So when is the ideal time to daven mincha? Is it, we call mincha gedola? Is it the early mincha, as soon as it's the zman? That's when you should daven? Or is it the last possible time, essentially right before Maariv? We talked a little bit last week about when the zman is for mincha Maariv in a different context. But is it that last moment, right, going into the nighttime, that's when mincha is best expressed? So what is the machlokas about? So the various farim talk about different themes that come out in mincha, and they suggest that if you say that mincha should ideally be recited at the end of the day, essentially, it's kind of a mini ne'ilah. The ne'ilah you have at the very end of Yom Kippur, and that maybe every day we have a mini ne'ilah, our last minutes of the day, we should have that kind of experience in miniature. While if you say that it should be the earliest time, it's a little bit the opposite of that. It's essentially right smack in the middle of your day, not like Shacharis, which gets the start, and not like Maariv at the end, but it's right smack in the middle of the day that you have to interrupt what you're doing. And the truth is, maybe you could say, Al Pi Derech HaDrush, that represents maybe two halves of the Yeshiva University experience. That on the one hand, so you have the mincha in the middle of the day, that whatever you're doing, you're out there and you're working and you're making a living and you are contributing to the world. And it's crucial that as you do that, you have a God-directed mindset, that you have an attitude that is informed by your religious values, and that specifically, right in the middle of your involvement in all of these things, you pause and you think about, okay, why am I here and what am I doing? But there's more to it also. And it's not only that we want to make a living in a way that reflects our value and values, as we heard last night also from my Willig and others, but it's also that we believe that everything comes together to contribute to who we are as people. So the ability to stop at the end of the day and think about, okay, who was I today and who am I going to be tomorrow, and to have that Yom Kippur experience in miniature, essentially on a daily level, so mincha also offers that opportunity. So perhaps if we can integrate both of those concepts into how we relate to mincha, whatever time of the day it is, then that helps us connect to a lot of what we're hoping we'll get out of our college experience and our smich experience and our yeshiva university experience as a whole. And maybe it's something that's very appropriately thought of right before mincha time today. So on that note, well, you know, the Gemara says that ein omdim l'hispalo, you shouldn't get up to daven if you're in the middle of a very complicated sugya, or you're distracted by something else. If you have other things on your mind, that's why we say Ashrei every day before mincha, because on the one hand, it's Torah, so it'll redirect us from other kind of things, but it's not particularly complicated Torah. It's not a pilpul that's going to possibly distract us. But to think about what mincha is about, that's probably a legitimate kind of perspective to bring into the mincha experience, and especially as we anticipate Hanukkah to maybe have some kind of a combination of those ideas, maybe it should be a valuable perspective for us towards mincha. Okay, so I guess we'll stop here. 2 minutes.